Athena, we stand out. Therefore, listener, to us have had me first first ten or not, to advise so specifically, even if it is our place, it's not its new order, there's a last negative fit.
In the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. In the kingdom of the paranoid, the one-eyed man is a spy. This is Paranoid Planet.
I welcome this kind of examination because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
Esta nunca ha sido dictadura, señores. Esta es dicta blanda.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
I don't like them putting chemicals in the water that turn the friggin' frogs gay.
I'm not gonna give you a question. You are fake news.
Silent Green is people!
Welcome to the third part of episode 7.8, in which we commemorate the 60th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, with two guests who have a direct connection with the Warren Commission and with the annual gatherings of conspiracy believers in Dealey Plaza. If you missed our interview with filmmaker James Lambert, or the first part of our interview with former Warren Commission counsel Bert Griffin, feel free to go back and listen to them first. This episode will make a lot more sense if you do. Or you can do everything in reverse, like those crazy kids in the 70s who spun their rock records backwards only to learn that Paul McCartney was dead.
Number nine, number nine, number nine, Honey Underman.
But just like President Kennedy told us, or was it the Electric Light Orchestra? I can't remember. The music is reversible, but time is not. So let's get cracking. Chapter 3B. Historians will prove us wrong.
Both Russia and America were building up huge stockpiles of nuclear weapons. Enough to destroy the entire planet several times over, in case they missed the first time. In 1959, there had been a communist revolution in Cuba. A man called Fidel Castro rose to power and immediately made friends with Russia.
Then in 1962, America discovered the Soviets were going to use Cuba as a base for nuclear missiles.
American President and pinup John F. Kennedy demanded the Russians remove the missiles, otherwise war was inevitable.
For 6 days, the world held its breath, meaning it might die from asphyxiation before the bombs even went off.
In the end, Soviet Emperor Nikita Khrushchev backed down like a shameful fucking chicken, and his missiles went home with their tails between their legs. Kennedy was victorious.
John F. Kennedy won the Cuban Missile Crisis. Why did he shoot himself afterwards?
Well, he didn't. He negotiated a settlement to the Cuban Missile Crisis with the Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev. And then after that, he ended up being assassinated in Dallas, Texas in 1963, unfortunately. But he didn't fire the bullet.
Right. It's ironic that he was so concerned about Cuban missiles when it was a gun in Texas he should have been worried about. I bet he was kicking himself after he was shot.
Judge Bert Griffin, welcome back to Paranoid Planet. And I say welcome back because our listeners may have just been listening to the first part of this interview just a few minutes ago, but this is actually a week later. So we've time traveled into the future, past Halloween, and we find ourselves again talking about the Kennedy assassination. Did you dress up for Halloween?
I should have, but I forgot all about it.
Oh, you didn't dress up like a judge.
Never would.
So a quick summary of what we did before. This is for ourselves, maybe more than our listeners. We talked about the Warren Commission, and we talked about its composition, particularly the junior counsels. We talked about its inner workings. Then we talked a little bit about the part that you played investigating Jack Ruby. We went on to talk about Lee Oswald and particularly his interest in General Walker and why you believe that Oswald became obsessive with General Walker as a future Hitler, and he felt that assassinating him or blaming him for the assassination may have been part of his plan. And then finally, we talked about Jack Ruby himself and some of his concerns and fears about anti-Semitism. So we've kind of went around the bases talking about the Kennedy assassination proper, and I thought what we would do now is talk more about the last few chapters of your book, about the legacy, the history of the Kennedy assassination. Is that all right with you?
Sure.
So in the closing chapter of your book, you end with these words, and this is, to be specific, page 316 of JFK, Oswald, and Ruby, Politics, Prejudice, and Truth. So you say this, quote, "Historians have a mission. Should they be willing, replace fiction with fact. Show that truth is stranger and can be more interesting than fiction. Lee Oswald and Jack Ruby were not conspirators in an unsolved murder mystery. Their lives and actions tell us poignantly about the early 1960s and what followed the tragic weekend. Chief Justice Warren believed that history would prove us right. Historians, he is still waiting." End quote. Now, I'm a historian myself, and I've written a book about Kennedy, so I think I'm part of the solution, at least I hope so. But I also know a lot of historians who have taken upon themselves to talk about the Kennedy assassination, not in a conspiratorial fashion, but to try to, as you say, set the record straight. I'm thinking about William Manchester, Robert Dalek, James Giglio, Larry Sabato, and there's others, many journalists, lawmen. We're talking about Gerald Posner, Vincent Bugliosi, etc. So how have historians failed to rectify the record of the Kennedy assassination?
Well, I think that historians have been intrigued with being forensic scientists and looking at questions of how many bullets were fired, whether they went through, a single bullet went through both Kennedy and Connolly, and have not focused on what historians, I believe, should focus on, and that is, who was Oswald? What was motivating him? What were the circumstances of the times that could have created such a situation that would have caused the President of the United States to proceed in a motorcade with no protection whatsoever? And I don't know why they're not interested in that, because I think when you get into the question of who was Oswald, it's a fascinating story, and I recommend it to many, many people that they read Priscilla McMillan's book, Marina and Lee. And I don't know why. Maybe you can help me with this. Did that have any impact on you, Michelle? Have you read it?
I haven't read it. I think in the previous part of our interview, I said that I felt that I got a good bit of our argument reading Posner, reading William Mailer, and also she gave a number of interviews, say, to PBS. There's a famous documentary by Frontline called Who Was Lee Harvey Oswald? And she actually does a number of interventions there, along with Robert Oswald and some other people who were close to him, Ruth Payne. Yes. So I felt that I got a lot of that personal story about Lee and Marina through that. I don't belittle at all what Priscilla McMillan did, but I think it's because it's an older book written in the 70s, many people have since been able to add to it. But maybe this is one thing that I need to do, is go back and read that one as well.
Yeah. Well, let me say that they have not been able to add to it, because Marina and Lee, Marina and Priscilla, for practical purposes, lived together from sometime in August of 1964 until sometime after Christmas time in 1964. And Marina unburdened herself to Priscilla. And I think that Marina said things to Priscilla that they never would have, she never would have spoken to a man, and a man wouldn't have had such a relationship that the details of questions that Priscilla asked would have ever been asked. So I think that when you suggested that people have added things, they haven't added anything because nobody has spent that much time with Marina Oswald, who knew Lee better than anybody else.
Yeah, I meant added more in the context of some of his personal contacts. For instance, I read all of Robert Oswald's biography of his brother, and I found it very insightful. Though, to be frank, he and their older brother, John Pick, had very little contact with Oswald after he joined the Marines. So it did give us a very interesting sketch of his youth, something that Marina was not necessarily aware of. But those years, you're right, Priscilla McMillan probably did the best in terms of understanding what happened in the weeks and months before the assassination. And I could add to what you're saying there, I read pretty much all of Vincent Bugliosi's very large book, Reclaiming History. And there is a section at the end where he does interview Marina Oswald, right? One of the few interviews she gave in the 21st century.
Right.
And she does sound kind of hostile, right? She doesn't really want to go into detail. She didn't really want to talk to Bugliosi. I'm not sure it's because she disliked him as a person, or she seems to have had regrets about laying her story out, and maybe even by now thinking maybe Lee did have some, you know, contact with the KGB or the CIA that she was not aware of. So she's embraced some of the conspiracy views more in the last few decades than she did back in the 60s, correct?
I'm not sure that she's embraced the conspiracy views. I think it seems to me she has come to believe that he might be innocent. He might not have been the shooter. I don't know whether she was hostile to Bugliosi. I think Bugliosi had the ability both to create hostility in witnesses, but also,
you know, your prosecutors, so they might have a tendency to do that.
I think he also had the tendency to reach out and to try to gain their confidence. Though I don't know what her attitude was toward Bugliosi, but I'm not at all surprised that she's changed her views on what she ought to say.
Okay. Now, do you see her as a reliable narrator? Because there's a lot of authors, not just conspiracy authors, believe that because she did not want to be sent back to the Soviet Union, because maybe her uncle was a member of the equivalent to the FBI in Russia, there's a lot of things weighing against Marina Oswald, maybe also guilt of being the cause of Oswald's actions because she spurned his affection the night before. So are there things where you feel that Marina Oswald is giving a very select view of what happened with Lee?
I think the questioning of Marina evolved. You know, she in 1963 and 1964, she was questioned numerous times, and I think at the beginning she had great reluctance to share anything, but I think by the time she came to the end of being questioned by the Warren Commission, I think she saw it in her self-interest actually to be as outspoken and as revealing and as truthful as possible. She did liken Earl Warren to her grandfather, and she said she would never lie to her grandfather. And if you read Marina's testimony, her feelings about the Chief Justice really seem to come through. The bottom line is, I think that by the end of her testimony, she was determined to tell the truth, and I think she believed that only by telling the truth could she remain in the United States.
Okay, so let's move on. Talking about historians, Marina Oswald, I'd like to talk about conspiracy authors that you mention in your book. Now, you've mentioned people like Mark Lane. We've talked about him. You mentioned Richard Popkin, the originator of the two Oswalds theory. You mentioned Harold Weisberg, who is one of the more further to the left authors who believe that I believe he believed that the military-industrial complex was at play in the assassination. But you don't go into a lot of detail on these men, surprisingly. My book does, but you prefer to focus on Edward J. Epstein, which in many ways is one of the more moderate authors. Some have even wondered if he is a conspiracist. So why do you think that Edward Epstein's book, it was called Inquest, The Warren Commission and the Establishment of Truth, published in 1966. Why do you think Epstein played such an important role in muddying the waters of history?
Well, I think it's because Epstein's book had a political impact that the others did not. Epstein published his book while he was working on a PhD at Harvard. His book was actually his thesis for a master's degree, I believe, at Cornell. But he had the cloak of not only academia, he had the cloak of Harvard academia. And so when his book was read, both by Schlesinger, they embraced that book, and they urged that a second investigation be undertaken. And I think he was the first author really to have that kind of impact.
Okay. Did you ever meet Epstein?
I never met Epstein, no. He never interviewed me. His interests were in Oswald and not in Ruby.
Well, then let's move on to people you have met. For the last couple questions, I'd like to hear your reactions to some of the recent books that have fostered conspiracy chatter. One of them is Philip Sheenan's A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Warren Commission. We've mentioned it earlier. And Paul Landis's The Final Witness, A Kennedy Secret Service Agent Breaks His Silence After 60 Years. So let's start with Sheenan. Personally, I found Philip Sheenan's History of the Warren Commission, on one hand, to be a very detailed and informative chronicle of how the commission's investigation and the commissioners did their job, right? In fact, this is where I first heard about you and a lot of the other assistant counsels. On the other hand, though, Sheenan makes some pretty speculative claims and controversial accusations regarding the commission's alleged failure to look into Oswald's Cuba connections, as well as the role of the CIA and the FBI, which he seems to think was duplicitous. And he also paints a fairly disparaging picture of Wesley Liebler, your fellow investigator and friend, who apparently never met a young lady that he didn't try to bed.
Right.
So without going into too much details about Liebler's personal life, did you believe that Sheenan's book helped or hindered our understanding of the Warren Commission's work?
It was a well-written book, and it probably helped. I came to have a lot of positive feelings about Sheenan. I spent a lot of time with him, but he responded to the temptation that goes with marketing the book, and that is he had to have something sensational in it. So he had to play with the idea that Oswald had a sexual relationship with Sylvia Duran in Mexico City, for which I think there's absolutely no evidence of that. And it doesn't have much relevance to whether he committed the assassination and whether he was involved in a conspiracy.
Would you agree maybe it was just to tie him in closer to Castro?
No, I think it was to sell books.
Okay.
And I hate to say that, but publishers want to have something sensational and they want, or sexual. The other part that I was concerned about was his suggestion, his story, that William Coleman had a private meeting with Castro in the course of our Warren Commission investigations, met on an island somewhere in the Caribbean, never told any of the rest of us about it. And let me say that he doesn't disclose that at the time he interviewed Coleman, Coleman was in an advanced state of Alzheimer's. I talked to the co-author of the book that Coleman wrote about his own experience, and Coleman does not mention at any point in the book that he met with Castro. He denied that he met with Castro at an earlier stage in his life. When Sheenan heard about the Castro meeting story, he heard it because someone had years later told it to Dave Slauson, who was one of our investigators. And Slauson so passed that information on to Sheenan. And when Sheenan came to speak with Coleman, Coleman just referred him back to Slauson and said whatever Slauson said was true. But here he at that stage, that it's Coleman at that stage, was in some advanced stage of Alzheimer's.
And Slauson had no memory of Coleman speaking to Castro.
Slauson's story to me changed as I talked with him. At first, he couldn't remember ever having been told this and thought he heard it somewhere from John Hart Ely. And he then told me that he contacted Eli, and Eli said he had never had such a conversation with Coleman. So Slauson's own story kept changing. But the fact that the co-author of Coleman's book never put in the book the story about Coleman, and I asked the co-author if Coleman had ever told him about such a story. And he said he had never told him such a story. Now, obviously, it would have been in the kind of autobiography, the memoir that Coleman wrote, I'm sure, if it had actually happened. So I think that Shannon had an obligation, and I raise this question with historians. Don't you have an obligation to question whether people are telling you the truth? And I think there are lots of reasons to think that the story he was getting, which was a story that came from Slauson and not from Coleman, should not have been put in the book. But it sold the book, helped sell the book.
Because it's gossip, it doesn't really belong there, because no one seems to agree exactly on who said what to whom.
That's right.
All right, so let me follow that up. I have a question about Paul Landis. Now, apparently Paul Landis, former Secret Service officer, lives near you, and the two of you have met not too long ago, and maybe before.
He also, may I say, Michelle, he purchased a copy of my book and asked me to autograph it, which I did.
That's good. That's good. Very gracious of you.
Yes.
Former Secret Service agent Paul Landis, who I believe was riding on the follow-up car on the day of the assassination. He was sort of the junior agent in charge of taking care of Mrs. Kennedy's protection, along with Clint Hill, who is usually the person we hear about in these matters. So Paul Landis has recently published a book in which he discussed finding a whole bullet, not the fragments that allegedly struck Kennedy in the head, but a whole bullet, presumably the single bullet, on the top, if I got this right, on the top of the rear seat of Kennedy's limousine moments after the president was carried into Parkland Hospital, where he was soon declared dead. So Mr. Landis does not claim that this proves a conspiracy took place, but his narrative does clash with what the Warren Commission reported regarding the shape and the size of the projectile, and what wounds it caused, and how it made its way onto a stretcher in Parkland Hospital. The media, however, has given this part of the book a lot of attention and treated it like evidence of a possible conspiracy. How do you respond to Agent Landis's recent foray into the JFK literature, particularly about finding this bullet in the rear of the limousine?
I knew that this account was going to come out in the news media before it did, because the person who was helping him with this, in promoting this account, has been a longtime friend of mine who also lives within walking distance of my house.
There's a lot of popular people living in Shaker Heights.
Yeah, certainly are. We're all part of a conspiracy.
You're all part of that elite club running the world from Shaker Heights.
Well, hardly that. But let me say that I feel very sorry for Paul Landis. I think he's a nice person. And I think that this is what one would call a false memory. False, first of all, because we know absolutely that the bullet that struck Kennedy in the back of the neck exited from the front of his neck. We know that for a couple of reasons. One, the Parkland Hospital doctors found a wound, a bullet wound in his neck, and they actually thought that it was an entry wound, but because it was of such a shape that it did not seem to be tumbling at that time. But we know from the fibers on Kennedy's shirt that the fibers in the front of the shirt were moved in such a direction, and the fibers came from the bullet hole, from whatever went through his neck, were moved in what I'll call an outward direction. So that the forensic evidence and the autopsy evidence really shows that there was a bullet that went through the back of Kennedy's neck and exited the front.
This is evidence that you did have at the time of the Warren Commission and that you considered to determine whether the single bullet theory was strong.
Absolutely correct. And furthermore, if there had been two entry wounds, that is an entry wound from the back of the neck and an entry wound where the tracheotomy was performed, then there would have been some bullet in Kennedy's body. It could be that Landis thinks he's finding the first bullet that hit him, that presumably struck him in the back of the neck. But where's the second bullet that would have gone in? So it made no sense. And incidentally, the pathologists were the ones that came up with the single bullet theory. It wasn't the Warren Commission. Our job was to determine whether that was a valid conclusion that the pathologists had reached. And so that the subsequent evidence that we had about the fibers in the shirt and so forth, yes, that was evidence that we developed in the course of our investigation, but did not come from the pathologists. In any event, it was just impossible. What Landis is saying is just impossible. I think Landis is an honest, decent person. I think he now believes that he has that memory. And I think people can have false memories. The further confirmation of that is that he, within a week of the assassination, he wrote two statements to the Secret Service, two reports to the Secret Service. In neither one of them does he even mention having found a fragment. On the 20th anniversary of the assassination, or about the 20th anniversary of the assassination in 1983, he told a newspaper reporter that he had found a fragment in the car. He repeated the fragment story on the 25th anniversary to another newspaper reporter, but he never reported finding a bullet. One of my colleagues, who about 5 years ago wanted to interview Landis, another person from Shaker Heights, may I say, who was putting a documentary together, Landis declined to talk to my friend who was producing the documentary because he was planning to write a book and wanted to reveal some things in the book. Well, it's kind of strange that you've come up with this conclusion at least 5 years ago and you don't want to tell anybody. You want it to come out in the book. So I think he's been influenced. I think he may have a true belief, but I think he's also been influenced by publishers.
What you're saying makes me think of two things. The first one is by mentioning the idea of a false memory. We're not mocking somebody. We're not calling them liars. I've seen this quite a bit in the study of ufology. You know, a lot of people claim to have seen funny lights in the sky, but many months later, maybe years after hypnosis or nightmares, they start to have memories of things that clearly didn't happen because there were witnesses there, or it doesn't fit any timeline, but they are convinced that they had a particular experience. And Landis would not be the only person to have had a form of trauma that day. I think it was in the Atlantic article. Was it the Atlantic? It was an article by James Robinault in Vanity Fair.
Vanity Fair, yes. Yes, it was.
So it was in the Vanity Fair article that he mentions, or he's reported to have had PTSD based on his experience of that day. And there are other witnesses, including Gene Hill, a very unreliable witness,
right,
who was just a few feet away from the limousine at the time of the fatal shot, who remembers things like a dog in the limousine or white roses,
right,
a puff of smoke, a shooter in a different place than even those who believe in a grassy knoll shooter to be. So, and Gerald Posner, I think, writes very well about that whole episode, how you could be so close and remember things so wrongly. And sometimes it's because trauma really messes with our memories of what we experienced at that time. So that could be the case. I also thought that his account does reinforce the single bullet theory insofar as if he did find a bullet in the car, it would explain how the bullet that struck Governor Connally and got dislodged from his thigh fell out of his pants while he was being carried into the hospital. Now, would it have made its way to the place that he says he found it? I don't know. But I think it helps us actually reduce the number of assumptions we need to make about how a bullet that struck Governor Connally ended up in a stretcher some, 400 feet away from the car.
Let me say also on this that, as I indicated to you, the person who wrote the Vanity Fair article is also a neighbor of mine.
Oh, they just keep popping up.
Well, you know, he's a Shaker Heights resident. I've known him for 20 or 30 years. He's a lawyer in town that I know. I've had a social relationship with him. He and my wife have gone to dinner with him and his wife. So I came to him because he has published a number of books, and I wondered if he could be helpful to me in getting publicity for my book. And this was before the Landis article was published and the Landis book was published. He told me he had something that he had to reveal to me, and he revealed the Landis story. I suggested to him that this was a false memory and that he had to protect Landis in this. I did not suggest to him that this was an accurate memory. And I didn't go into a lot of details with him as I've gone into with you to show factually why I think it was completely impossible. I think the writer of the Vanity Fair article could be very helpful to Landis and could have been helpful to him in writing the book, because I think, as you've been saying, Michelle, the false memory is an example of what a traumatic experience can do to you. And he could have modified the book and could have helped. And I would have urged Landis to go to an appropriate psychologist or psychiatrist, whoever he needed for help with his PTSD, and let him come to the conclusion that it was a false memory. Let it be published in the book as a false memory. Now, one of the important witnesses to the assassination, Howard Brennan, has written a book about his experience. And he talks about the impact of his having seen the shooter and the long-term effect that it has had on him. So I think this could have been a very useful part of this book on Landis's part, if he could have helped Landis understand that it was a false memory. But now he's got people who are, unfortunately, like myself, who are attacking his, I don't want to attack his credibility, although I am attacking his credibility, but it's not to say that this man is a deliberate liar. I think he's been seriously affected, as you, Michelle, have said, by this horrible experience of having seen the president being shot. Clint Hill have responded to it by saving the president's wife. I mean, she could have gone off the back of that car if Clint Hill hadn't responded. So there could be guilt feelings that Landis has, that maybe he didn't respond as quickly as Clint Hill. And that's completely normal. But that's what he should have been protected from and not encouraged to go on and give this completely incredible story.
I should point out that Clint Hill was vilified by many conspiracy theorists as being somehow part of a conspiracy when he himself became an alcoholic and I think a painkiller addict for a couple decades after the fact, because it was such a traumatic experience on him as well. Another thing that kind of interested me, and I'll finish with this about Paul Landis, is I noticed that in the Vanity Fair article, it mentions that Landis read, one of the first books on Kennedy's assassination he read, was Josiah Thompson's 6 Seconds in Dallas, back in 1968.
Right.
And I read it to write my book, and I often thought that Josiah Thompson was one of the more rational conspiracy theorist. I mean, he's a philosopher and he wrote about Kierkegaard, and I'm a big fan of Kierkegaard. So I kind of had a weak spot for Josiah Thompson until the University of South Florida asked me to review his most latest book, Last Second in Dallas. And I was astounded at the number of fallacies, the mistakes he made. And he also has a section about this bullet, claiming it was a pointed bullet, not a rounded bullet. So I'm wondering if the book itself or further conversations with Josiah Thompson helped create this false memory, this inaccurate memory in Paul Landis's mind. You know, I don't want to pick on Paul Landis, but I do want to pick on Josiah Thompson, because I think that he should know better than to spread a lot of the things that he has, which are demonstrably inaccurate.
You know, I'm puzzled by a lot of the people who are very, very bright, who latch on to the idea that there might have been a conspiracy. And let me say that that every one of us that was working on the Warren Commission wanted to find a conspiracy. Can you imagine what somebody like me with a political ambition would have had? I, as I've said before, I would have been the senator from Ohio and not John Glenn.
You'd be the president.
We wanted to find a conspiracy, but we were forced to look at all the facts, and we talked with each other. And we talked with Jim. Jim, believe it or not, could disagree on a lot of things. When you were required to look at all of the evidence and evaluate it, you had to come up with the conclusion that Oswald did it and that there's nobody that he was connected to. Now, why is it that Hosea Thompson, who I think is known as Tink?
Yes, that's right.
Tink Thompson went to Yale College. You had to be, not only it helped to be have some money, but it also helped to be bright. So I think he's a bright guy. He has a PhD in philosophy. But why can he not look at the other evidence that would contradict what he wants to believe? You have a psychology degree, don't you?
History, political science.
Oh, okay. Well, we need a psychologist in this to help us understand these people.
Bring your wife in.
Yeah, I'll bring my psychoanalytic wife in. I think they want to be, I think they really want to be truthful and honest, but they somehow leave out some very important facts. That's where we are.
Is there anything that you would like to add about the Warren Commission, Jack Ruby, Lee Harvey Oswald, or conspiracy theories?
Well, I may not be adding it, but I may be repetitive. But I want to say that the Chief Justice in our first staff meeting said to us, your only client is the truth. And that was clearly the message that we retained and have retained to this day. And what has happened as the criticisms of the Warren Commission have gone on over the years, we have asked some of us, myself, I supported the idea of creating the Assassination Records Review Board. I thought every bit of evidence that could possibly exist ought to be in the public record.
That was you? I thought Oliver Stone said he did that.
Well, as I say in my book, when we saw Oliver Stone's movie, we were very upset by it. And a group of us met in D.C., including Jim Liebler, and we, staff people, and we agreed that we had asked that something be done. Arlen Specter was a part of the group. Dave Bellin and Norman Redlich held a press conference asking that all of the records that be produced that existed, that nothing be classified. Arlen co-sponsored the resolution or whatever it was that created the Assassination Records Review Board. So we didn't want anything to be concealed. And let me say that Bellin, when Bellin was the chief of staff, chief counsel, I guess, for the Rockefeller Commission, which was looking at activities of the CIA, Bellin was the person from the staff who, the Warren Commission staff, who uncovered the fact that the CIA was trying to assassinate Castro. And he played a role, that is, Dave Bellin played a role in creating the House Select Committee on Assassinations.
Was he involved in the Church Committee in any way, or the Rockefeller Commission?
He was the, I'm going to call him the general counsel, chief of staff, whatever it was, for the Rockefeller Commission. He passed it on to the Church Committee, and he, as I say, he himself called for a creation of a second congressional investigation. So as far as the staff is concerned, we were determined and have always been determined to try to find the truth. Those who attempt to attack the integrity of the Warren Commission, which includes its staff and which includes the Chief Justice, are absolutely false. This, in fact, should be looked upon as a tremendous investigation. We reviewed over interviews of over 20,000 witnesses. There's never been a crime, homicide or otherwise, it's been as thoroughly investigated, even at the stage of the Warren Commission, as that has. So this was a genuine effort to get the truth and to publish the truth, because we believed that that failure to publish the truth would backfire. And we had to have the truth out. What would we have done if there had been, we had found evidence of a conspiracy? That it would have had to have gone on in a private way, but as a part of a criminal investigation. We wouldn't have published a report that said, we think there's a conspiracy and more investigation needs to be done, because we needed to find a conspiracy if one possibly existed. And we were satisfied that there was zero evidence of any conspiracy, and that's the public could be told that. And as people have then suggested that there's evidence that we did not uncover, and there was evidence that was withheld from us, and two very important parts of evidence. I'm not sure in our prior conversation, Michelle, whether we talked about what the CIA concealed from us and what FBI agent Hostie concealed from us. Those are very important bits of information that we should have had. With respect to the Hostie concealment, frankly, I think it confirms the fact that there was very unlikely that Oswald even thought about assassinating the president until a few days before the assassination. And with respect to the CIA, the fact that they were trying to assassinate Castro, we would have gone into that very, very thoroughly. And the fact that the CIA withheld information from us, and the fact that Hostie not only withheld information from us, he destroyed evidence of us, it causes people to distrust government. I do not urge people to be paranoid, but I do urge them to be skeptics, and that we must look at every bit of evidence, skepticism, and ask the questions, is it true or is it not true? What other evidence is there that confirms or contradicts this?
Well, if you had told me all this 25 years ago in the heyday of when I was, I would say, in the Church of Oliver Stone on the conspiracy bandwagon, Judge Griffin, I would have said, you're a lying liar who lies. But I've changed my mind because I read the report, I read Posner, I've done a lot of investigation, I've read the ARRB depositions and a lot of the other ones from the other. And yes, I'll say something Americans often say to military men, thank you for your service. Because I think that because of people like you and Mr. Bellin and Liebler and others, you've really made a big effort to try to untangle one of the world's biggest piles of spaghetti, so that people could understand it better. And maybe historians should have done a better job. I'd like to think that there's many out there who have tried to. But as I say in my book, sometimes it's not the story people want to hear. And so they go about listening to something more complicated and more fanciful because it allows them to deal with certain feelings of anxiety or anger, as mistrust, distrust, their feelings about government cover-ups and things like that. And sometimes they're not wrong, right? The Church Committee,
yes.
The Rockefeller Commission, they show that these things do happen, but not in this case.
Well, thank you so much for what you're doing and for this opportunity to talk to your listeners.
Well, thank you. So what I'd like to do now, if you still have about 10 minutes or so, is I'd like to end our interviews with a little game. Would that be okay with you?
Absolutely.
Okay, so this game is called Judge Not, Lest Ye Be Judged. And, of course, Jesus admonished his believers not to judge others. But he never told them not to become judges. And since you are a judge, you've earned the right to make certain decrees. So here are 10 famous people who may or may not, actually maybe there's 9 because some of them get repeated. But here's a list of 10 claims about people who have done really bad things. I want you to tell us whether you believe they are guilty as charged or not guilty in the sense that it is not known beyond a reasonable doubt. So the first, guilty or not guilty, did Lee Harvey Oswald visit Cuban expatriate Sylvia Odio in Dallas in late September 1963?
No.
No, so not guilty. He didn't show up at Odio's house.
Yeah.
I don't think he did either, but Vincent Bugliosi is willing to believe that he did without necessarily that feeding into the conspiracy viewpoint.
Incidentally, I think Sylvia Odio is also a truthful person. I think Sylvia honestly believes that the person she saw was Lee Harvey Oswald. So I don't put her in the liar category, as I will later on with some others.
Okay. Noted. Duly noted. That's good to know. Number two, did Joseph Stalin have Leon Trotsky murdered?
Yes. Beyond a reasonable doubt.
It's not hard. It's not hard to ascribe murder to Joseph Stalin. All right. And it was pretty gruesome, too. I believe it was an axe in the back. Number three, did the Las Vegas police conspire to kill Tupac Shakur?
I don't even know who he is.
He was one of those Los Angeles gangsta rappers of the 1990s. His parents were Black Panthers, and many conspiracy theorists believe that it was not a drive-by shooting by a rival gang, but rather it was a murder orchestrated by the police department and the FBI to kill a famous rap star. So you're pleading the fifth on this one. Is that correct? Number four. Did George W. Bush intentionally lie about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
I don't think he did.
You don't think he did?
Not guilty.
Do you believe he received false information that he took to be true?
I think that's right.
Okay. I believe that Vincent Bugliosi was willing to prosecute George Bush over this.
Really?
So it would be interesting to know if Vincent was around today to see if you guys could debate this further.
Well, I respect Vincent, and he knows a lot more about what information Bush got.
Okay, so George W. Bush, not guilty. You heard it first. Did O.J. Simpson murder his estranged wife, Nicole?
I would have found him guilty based on what I see.
All right. Guilty as charged. Number six, is the U.S. Air Force hiding evidence of extraterrestrial spacecraft in Nevada's Area 51?
Not guilty.
Not guilty.
Yeah.
Seven. Now, I promised I wouldn't talk about the Cleveland Browns, but I have to. Did Art Modell intentionally make the Browns tank by losing to the Denver Broncos in the semifinals so he could move them to Baltimore?
No, I don't think he did.
But we'd like to think he did, right?
He's guilty of a lot of other things, but that wasn't one of them. I am not an Art Modell lover. From the day he fired Paul Brown, I did not like the man.
Okay, so we can agree on one thing. He's a horrible, horrible man.
Yeah.
Number eight, did the music really die the day that Buddy Holly's plane crashed?
I'm ignorant of that also.
Oh, you didn't hear that song by, McDonald?
No, I'm still.
Bye Bye Miss American Pie. It's like a 1960s, 70s. The song is about the music died the day that Buddy Holly and the Crickets or whatever... and I think a couple other singers crashed in a plane. This is in the 50s, so I thought this was when you were
the 50s. I don't know. I probably never got out of the 40s.
Okay. Do you think the CIA killed Buddy Holly?
I doubt it.
Okay, all right. You're familiar with a group called the Beatles, right?
Yes, very much so. I like the Beatles.
Did Yoko Ono intentionally break up the Beatles?
Well, I don't know any of the evidence on that, but I guess I don't understand the social group in which the Beatles function. Guess I can't imagine. I can't think of any reason on my mind why you would break them up.
Well, in an American court of law, I heard that you don't have to prove motive. You only have to prove intent.
That's right.
Okay, so we don't know about Yoko Ono breaking up the Beatles, but did Yoko Ono make the music die?
You know, I'm not enough of a Beatles fan to know anything about that. I plead ignorance.
But have you ever heard Yoko Ono sing?
No.
Oh, okay, well, I have, and I think I can firmly conclude for the both of us, Judge, that Yoko Ono did, in fact, try to murder the music.
Okay.
All right. Okay, well, we're going to end this very interesting interview. I'm very happy to have you on. I usually end with a little award ceremony and also a surprise question from the question jar.
Oh, all right.
Do you have the courage to answer the question jar?
I do.
You do. All right. drill deep in here, pull this one out. And the question is, what is your favorite girly drink?
I don't even know what a girly drink is.
It would have to have color, maybe an umbrella. Maybe it has some smoke coming out of it or a fruit.
Scotch and soda. Scotch and soda is my favorite drink. So.
Scotch and soda. So let's say like a girly who flies missions for the Air Force and has a very husky voice.
You got a great question, Jar. Can I mention one thing?
Yes, please do before I give you your awards.
Okay. I hope that people will be interested enough in what I have written to read my book. And the name of the book is easy to remember, JFK, Oswald, and Ruby, Politics, Prejudice, and Truth.
Yes, and I was going to plug it as well, but thank you for doing that. Do you have any plans for the 60th anniversary?
Strangely enough, my wife are going to celebrate our meeting on the 60th anniversary. So that's one good thing. One thing I can thank Executive Action for. Not much else, but I can thank them for that.
Mark Lane gave you a beautiful relationship.
Yes,
that's
he
great.
Did. Right.
That's a great thing. That's right. That's one good thing he provided the world.
Right.
Right. Where in my awards ceremony, first of all, I would like to welcome you into our not so secret society. We call it the Knitters, okay. Not the Freemasons. And the long name is the Ancient and Accepted Order of Speculative Haberdashery. So I don't know if you're a Freemason. If you were, you probably wouldn't tell me, though my friend Peter suspects there's a lot of them in Shaker Heights. But you are now also a Knitter, if that's the case.
Thank you much. I'm honored to be admitted.
And for you specifically, I have an award that I'm going to call. In fact, it's two awards. Imagine yourself with two little statuettes of Lee Oswald on one side and Jack Ruby on the other. And you now have the Hunter of Anti-Fascists Award. So I guess both Oswald and Ruby can be called anti-fascists.
Right.
Have you ever been to the West Neely street address? That's the house where Oswald took the picture.
I've been to the Beckett rooming house. I think I have, but I don't remember it.
Yeah, it's actually about four or five, I think, maybe a bit longer, but I think it's just a half a mile from the rooming house, because the picture of you in the rooming house is in your book.
Yes.
And I actually went just a couple summers ago to Dallas. And I went and I peeked over the backyard, and it looks the exact same as it does in the picture. Very little has changed of that house. It's been painted a few times, but I think they keep it around for movies and documentaries and things
sure.
like that. So
sure.
It's a little bit spooky. It's like a piece of history that never changed. So I don't know. Maybe we can make a picture of you holding a Mannlicher Carcano in the backyard if you want. Right. Next time we're both there.
Okay.
Right. So it was great to have you on. Thank you very much. We're meant to. Maybe I should plug this now, although it's not recorded. You and I and Gerald Posner are meant to take part in a three-way interview conversation with Michael Shermer in a week or two for us. It will have been already recorded for our listeners, so they can always mosey on to the Michael Shermer show and catch more of Judge Burt Griffin and friends. How's that sound?
It's a good plug.
All my best. Thank you for coming, and I wish you well.
All right. Same to you, Michelle.
History for Schools, take 8. Action!
Defeat at the castle seems to have utterly disheartened King Arthur. The ferocity of the French taunting took him completely by surprise, and Arthur became convinced that a new strategy was required if the quest for the Holy Grail were to be brought to a successful conclusion. Arthur, having consulted his closest knights, decided that they should separate and search for the Grail individually. Now this is what they did.
This is a public announcement on behalf of the Witless Relocation Program, proud sponsor of the Paranoid Planet podcast since 1987.
Oh man, I did bad.
What's the matter, Carl? Did you accidentally confess to a crime you didn't commit?
Yeah.
Again?
They said I'd feel better if I confessed.
Do you?
Yeah, no, not really. Nah, I need to rat out my friends now, or else I'll go to prison.
I didn't know you had any... I mean, that's quite a dilemma. But lucky for you, there's another option available.
Really? Like what?
Well, I'm happy you asked. It's called the Witless Relocation Program. And let's listen to Maurice explain it.
Who's Maurice?
Oh, he's just some guy, some French guy who's, well-connected.
I like him already.
Did you accidentally put salt instead of sugar in your morning coffee? Did you tie your shoes together and fell down the stairs at work again? Are you being mocked or ignored by your family and friends for your theories about vaccines, stolen elections, controlled demolitions, and Sasquatches? Did you see a puff of smoke and a fake police officer behind the bushes in Dallas's Dealey Plaza? Or did you mistake a plane formation? Or a parachute flare, a secret spy weather balloon, the planet Jupiter, a paper lantern, a flock of king pelicans, or a lenticular cloud for an alien spaceship? If any of these examples resembles your sad situation, you can still make a fresh start in a different state, province, or perhaps in France, with a brand new identity, a satchel of unmarked bills, and some fake ID cards to help you wipe clean your reputation as a local village idiot, and start a brand new life with a new job and a clean slate and maybe some women. All you need to do is notify us of your whereabouts at witless.com and to climb into the unmarked white van that will promptly send to your house. Just make sure that you are well rested, ate a light lunch, and pack a towel and ice pack for the long journey. You can start fresh as early as tomorrow. You've got nothing to lose, except a lung and maybe a kidney.
That's the Witless Relocation Program for manipulable bystanders, imaginative storytellers, and abject morons.
Hey, that could be me. I'm going to sign up right now. Thanks, podcast host guy.
No, thank you, Carl.
Wait, why do I need an ice pack?
Oh, you'll see. And that concludes episode 7.8 of the Paranoid Planet podcast and our commemoration of the 60th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. It was brought to you by the letters L and G, a full-page anti-Kennedy ad in a Dallas newspaper, The Ghost of Mark Lane, a 50-year-old love affair that began at a conspiracy movie, a green pickup truck that had nothing to do with a grassy knoll shooter, or did it, and a white van that may or may not serve as a clandestine organ harvesting clinic. Don't forget to visit our website at www.paranoidplanet.ca, where you can help us promote critical thinking and thoughtful public discourse with small, one-time or recurring donations, or read our illustrated essays, find a list of related readings and videos for every episode, admire artwork by Joan Lijo and Martin Hecker, order a copy of Michelle's JFK book, and, maybe, find out how Jack Ruby got inside the Dallas Police parking garage using a special jumpsuit that helped him shrink down and travel through the quantum realm. And don't forget to contact us at paranoidplanet.mail@gmail.com if you have any questions, comments, praise, or fatherly reprimands. On behalf of Joan Lijo, this is Michel Gagné saying, just because you'd love to be able to vote for a Kennedy, that doesn't mean you should vote for any Kennedy, if you know what I'm saying.
And we declare independence from the mercenary media that is here to fortify all of the corporate orthodoxies from their advertisers and to urge us to hate our neighbors and to fear our friends.
This was a Burden of Proof media production. We'll see you next time.
Paranoid Planet, a podcast about conspiracies, paradigm shift, and critical thinking.